Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today we're going to be talking about time in your D&D campaign. Is that important? How important? How do you handle it? Today on Wandering DMs.
Does anyone really know what time it is? Does anyone really care about
it's
time?
It's a really good philosophical question. And, you know, so we are recording this on the first day of Daylight Savings Time being changed. And so now I'm realizing the light in my room is all different where I'm sitting, and that confused me for a second. And I had to ask my partner Isabel, "Is it later or is it earlier?" And then she said, "Later or earlier than what?"
Excellent.
So yeah, I don't know if anybody does know what time it really is. So let's start with a little history. So one of the really interesting things, if you look into Gary Gygax's early rules, he just pounds on the issue of how incredibly important it is to keep time records in the campaign. And so there's a line in, so a lot of people, there's this like two-page section, two full-page section on this in the Advanced D&D DM's Guide. And there's this one, so people point to what you see on the screen right now, this line that starts that section that says, one of the things stressed in the original game of D&D was the importance of recording game time with respect to each and every player character in a campaign. In AD&D, it is emphasized even more, and then you get this all caps screamy section. You cannot have a meaningful campaign if strict time records are not kept. And then it goes on for two pages. And there's a whole big long example of like about five different parties and seven different characters, and some are in a dungeon and some are in the wilderness, and are all different places in the calendar, and how incredibly important it is to keep track of that. And I think some people point to this, like this particular section, go, was he high? What on earth are you talking about?
My conjecture about this has always been, it was very specific to the way he was running D&D at the time, where he had one consistent shared world that many players were playing in across different sessions.
Right? I totally agree. I think that's probably my thesis from this. And so, you know, so obviously my understanding is when Gary made this game, it's, you know, there's no computer games, right? And there's only one DM. There's like two DMs in the whole world at this point, and they're coming to Gary's house. And supposedly for about 6 months, he was running games every single night. With, you know, a different variety of players every night of just who could show up or who had more interest. And so I totally agree that, Paul, have you ever heard of anybody that was running campaigns with that same kind of, like, I've got 20 players and it's a random number that show up any night?
I mean, the closest that I've heard coming to that is the West Marches campaign style, which okay. I've run for a while. Actually, my West Marches campaign just recently ended. But that's the closest. But even that is still, for me at least, was pretty regimented of the world clock advances with the real clock. And right. So I never had to like worry about going back in time or who's where or whatever. But, you know, the thing I'm reminded of is actually I just last night I finally got to sit down and watch the Blackmore movie. What's that called? Secrets of Blackmore? Hey. Yeah.
So
based on our interview with D.H. Boggs, so I got to sit down and watch it, and it sounds also a lot like the way that Arneson was running things, right? Like that he had a huge group of players. He had some players who were like calling him up on the phone to do phone sessions, and other players who were showing up at different times, and he probably had to keep a really careful record of where is the game clock and where is this player in this game clock. But I think my gut tells me that that's just not manageable. That, like, if you're ever, like, dealing with, well, this player is 2 weeks ahead.
Yeah.
And now this player, I have to deal with what this player, player B is doing, which actually happened 2 weeks earlier than what player A did.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine trying to keep that straight.
Yeah.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah. I agree. Maybe let's look at the let's go back and look at the original D&D rule there, which is maybe a little bit more digestible. Hmm. So this is the very last thing in the original D&D rule. So this is the last page of the third volume of the Three Little Books. And right immediately before that is the natural healing rule. And this is the last thing. And so as you can see there, there's this very specific rule of if you go on a dungeon expedition, that takes 1 week. If you're in a wilderness adventure, then one move is 1 day. And then kind of like what you were just saying, Paul, this third thing here, 1 week of actual time is 1 week of game time. So that I always assume is your between sessions time advancing. Mm-hmm. And then it says, what does it say there? The time for wilderness expeditions includes days of rest and recuperation. And then actual time, and then kind of an interesting little footnote there. Actual time would not be counted off for players out on wilderness adventures, but it would be counted for those, I think hewed is what he's trying to say. They're hewed in their dens or hidey holes or keeps or castles, as well as those in the dungeon. So supposedly real time not affecting people in the wilderness, but yes, affecting people in dungeons or a town. So that's the original D&D rule. Yeah. And as you just said, in AD&D, the example is totally what you just said. You've got people on different tracks, and you have some people a month in the future from other people. And to my astonishment, the example in the AD&D book is of like Party A going into a dungeon and then like killing a monster, getting a treasure, and then Party B real time doing the same thing later on. But game calendar, it happens earlier than Party A, and therefore they retroactively retcon that Party A got that treasure because apparently Party B got it earlier in time.
Weird. Weird.
Yeah, which is like one of the craziest things. I can't imagine delivering that to players and having that be acceptable.
Yeah.
So
now, I do somewhat agree with the original statement of how important timekeeping is, if nothing else, because it is a resource, right? Whether you're exploring the dungeon or exploring the wilderness, how long does our torch last? How long do our rations last, right? How frequently do I check for wandering monsters? All that is super, super important. Viewer William mentions having played a character with lycanthropy. So yeah, like when's the full moon? That's really important.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that to death.
So certainly I'm used to keeping tabs of how much time has passed, and especially in terms of like when do resources run out or what other time limited things happen. I suppose there's actually also an inverse of that, which is I've written modules that include a timeline, right? That seems to be a bit of a trope, right? There are plenty of, especially your mystery style adventures,
right,
where at the beginning there's a timeline that says, you know, at day three this happens, at day five this happens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is a little bit of that having to deal with that time travel problem of, you know, oh, this is going to happen in the future. But at least it's NPCs, it's pre-written, it's scripted, and my assumption has always been like, this is the timeline, assuming the players do nothing, which of course is not what's going to happen. The players are going to do things and screw with the timeline, and then I'm going to have to readjust the timeline.
Right, right. Now, admittedly, I don't run a lot of those adventures, right? So I'm aware of those kinds of timelines. They make sense. Yeah. And admittedly, I don't run a lot of those adventures, so that tends not to be exactly the top thing that I'm dealing with.
Some of those adventures, I think, are more successful than others, and it comes down to, I think, how much the adventure anticipates that their timeline will be wrong.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Like, it sort of goes back to that old, Fear of a Black Dragon definition of what is old school, what is an old school module, and the notion that an old school module never has an ending, right? It has a beginning, definitely beginning, maybe some middle, maybe not, but, right. So, one of my favorites, and I'll talk about this again, I think, later, is, of course, the very classic Warhammer fantasy RPG game, wow, I just blanked on the title. The Enemy Within. Whew, there it is.
There you go.
Which the second one, I think, Shadows Over Bogenhaven, has exactly that, a timeline of these NPCs are doing these things at these times.
Right.
Actually, you know what? I just recently ran something Stinks and Stilton, which is another adventure that has a timeline in it, which is actually really fun because that adventure, again, is written very much in the here's what could happen.
Yeah.
And it really prepares you for, like, and even there's sections in the text where it says, well, if the players do this, that will ruin this part. And if the players do that, that will change this part, right?
Right. Good. Good.
Where those adventures fail is when they just say, this must happen. Bang, bang, bang. Here, these things must happen. And then you're like, well, okay, just write your book.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. That's a great point. That's a great point. So I think we agree that I've never had this, like, multiple parties at different times being managed. And you haven't. And I don't think we've ever heard of anybody that personally actually did it that way.
I've never seen it. Yeah, I've never seen it. I mean, I've contemplated it plenty of times. And like, especially the notion, I think maybe we explored it a little bit when we talked about 2DM games.
Yeah.
Right? Like, then the time becomes a really interesting issue.
Right. Right. So Paul and I have discussed the possibility of, like, running at a convention, like, two tables of with two DMs of two separate groups of players in the same situation. And the primary sticking point, I think, actually, was how do we synchronize the time so that if they cross paths, we know that they're in the same place at the same time.
Yep.
Right. That was the primary sticking point.
I think, you know, my inclination is always when in doubt, go to the real clock. Like, actual time.
Yeah.
When I was running West Marches, every week of time was a real week of time. So if the players didn't play for two weeks, then we had several weeks of downtime between sessions.
Yeah. I agree. And likewise, even within a session, you know, I just take my watch. I have my watch on the table in front of me. And for me, at least, that's actually what triggers Wandering Monster checks, is specific times on my watch, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
And I'm pretty happy with that. I'm pretty happy with me. And it takes away me being subjectively, like, me as DM. Well, the players are all having this big conversation between themselves. I'm bored, so I'm going to roll a wandering monster check to make it interesting for me, right? Which you can hopefully you can see what the major problem is with that. So it kind of takes it out of my hands by being objective with the actual real clock.
So how do you deal then with moments that would rapidly advance the game clock? For example, we're going to sleep in the dungeon. We're going to sleep.
Okay. Well, so the sleep. So I am very. I don't allow sleeping in the dungeon, to make a long story short.
Yeah.
But in other places, I'm very liberal about just that time has passed. Bam. Hmm. And so if there isn't any specific, for me, like, original D&D mechanical thing that's going to happen, I totally just move the pace forward by days at a time or weeks at a time, just by saying exactly that. And I'm pretty happy with that. You know, like, actually, in my game on Friday, we covered about 2 months in one game session. So we played for about 3 hours, and we covered about 2 months. Part of that is that for the first time ever, in my entire gaming experience, my players actually made their own new custom spell, right? And that takes a couple of weeks to research, and they burned through 40,000 value in treasure, actually, because they actually failed the first time and then they queued up to do it again. So I actually managed to suck 40,000 silver due to their request to make this new spell. And it took, three weeks, and it took another 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And what happened there? And then they were trying to learn a new spell. Someone was invisible for a week, right? Had a spell that lasted for a week. And I said, well, obviously that spell is over. And one of the players didn't even realize, and they said, really? It's already over? And I go, yeah, well, that actually just took 9 days.
Yep.
The thing, that those three die rolls that your wizard just made, that actually just took 9 days, so clearly that's over. Everyone was perfectly fine with that.
Yep. Great.
Yeah.
And
I'll say one thing I don't do, right? So one thing that occurred to me with this is, in some of those cases, I think some DMs would go, the wizard's doing this for 9 days, what are the rest of you doing? And I don't do that. Because I think that when you do that, you get in there and it's like you're asking the players to make up business that is kind of just going to waste time at the table.
Yep.
And so my attitude is if the players have something that's critical that they want to see happen, they can jump in and tell me, but I'm not going to prompt for the playing out the other five people going to the shop and the bars for 9 days.
You know, that's probably really wise, because I've definitely had sessions like that where, you know, where I've said, like, okay, there's this downtime, and then first player's like, oh, I spent 2 weeks doing blah, blah, blah. And I go, okay, great. Right. And then I just look, is anybody else doing anything with that 2 weeks? Yeah. And then the whole session slogs down. I actually really like that. That's great.
Yeah. And what I might, that worked really, really well. I mean, it really worked really well this past Friday night. And I almost have a feeling like if anybody else jumps in and says, like, I want to do this, I just might start tacking extra weeks on.
Yeah.
like I don't know whether I would even make that simultaneous or just start tacking more weeks on. But I mean, I could make it simultaneously, but I pointedly do not ask, what do you do during this time?
Interesting.
So, and then the game at the table seems to be better paced.
Just to go back real quick on the sleeping in the dungeon, wandering monsters thing, that's something that I've always enjoyed, the game clock mechanic, to just let the rules sort of train the players about why it's a bad idea. So my players say, oh, we're going to sleep. And I go, okay, so you're going to sleep for, what, 8 hours? Okay, so in the first hour, I'm going to roll 6 wandering monster checks. Plump. Okay, the first hour, nothing attacks you. Here's the second hour. Scoop up the dice again, right? And then they learn pretty fast, right? That, like, this is a terrible idea.
This is pretty legitimate. Yeah. Recently, I've just been telling new players, like, that's a bad idea.
Mm.
That's not going to happen.
Right.
But I should probably do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, you do it once with any group, and then they're like, okay, we get it.
I hope there are some people that like a really brand new player might just think that's the game, is like an unending swarm. Like, you, I apparently I need to fight an unending swarm of goblins coming at me overnight and actually queue up an attempt to do that, maybe.
Now I did have this come up recently in a fifth edition game I was running, which is also interesting because talk about very strict what time means, right? Short rest is 1 hour, and a long rest is 8 hours, of which at least 6 must be spent asleep. So,
which I recently learned, there's different options. Apparently, there's different options in the DM's guide, right?
For what a long rest is?
Yeah. So, oh, really? So Christian just pointed this out to me last week. Is apparently in the DM's guide, there's variants of like super heroic, whereby that time scale is advanced such that a short rest is 5 minutes and a long rest is 1 hour.
Okay.
And then there's a gritty variant in which a short rest is a day and a long rest is a week, I guess. Like that.
Okay. That makes sense. Sure. That's great. I like that they thought of that. I never noticed that in the book, but okay.
Yeah.
The interesting thing was in that dungeon, my players did find a clever way to hold themselves up, and I rolled all the checks. And none of the things that came up, the funny thing was, hi Scott, none of the things that came up actually either could get at them, or when they did come up, I thought, okay, well, this monster's smart, so it's not just going to like walk into their room, it's going to start to plot and plan. Yeah. And so they got through their long rest, but by the end of their long rest, it was kind of ironic because they were at a point where just before taking their rest, where they probably could have just finished the dungeon. Instead, they rested and gave the dungeon a chance to recuperate.
Okay.
And so, anyway, we're going down a tangent, but my point is, like, I don't know, I guess I just... there are cases where I like to strictly keep game time for mechanics like wandering monster checks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the most important things. Like, now, okay, so I'm just thinking about this resting in the dungeon thing.
Yeah.
So I think maybe I should do that. And I feel like on the same point, like a smarter monster would stay outside, lay an ambush, and then make a whole lot of noise so that the wizards can't sleep and get their spells. maybe that's what clever. I should do, actually.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah, that seems worse.
Now, I did try one thing once where when I was running a game... I was running a specifically intro game. I was taking this around to different places, trying to like teach, you know, hey, you've never played D&D, and let's play D&D. And I had an hourglass, a legit hourglass, right? The last 1 hour. And I would keep that at the table. And my game was scheduled for 4 hours. So I would tell them up front, I'm going to flip this thing 3 times during the course of play. And then, you know, and then we're done. Because I think I banked half an hour on either side for setup and for...
Yep. Good, smart.
And it was funny because I remember one player actually being really shocked and surprised when he said, "What happens when it runs out?" And I said, "The game's over." And he's like, "What?" "Yeah, the game, we're out of time. We can't play anymore. I have to go home." This was a surprise. Oh, I thought we got to play forever. Nope.
It's really funny. It's gotta end. You know, I got to say, it's really funny sometimes people being surprised by those logistics.
Yeah.
And I got to share a teaching anecdote because this was a number of years ago, but I was teaching a semester of like early like computer science one at a school in Massachusetts. And I, you know, the end of the semester comes and I say, so the final exam is on December 10th or whatever, something like that. So you plan on being here for that. And I did have a student come up at the end of that particular lecture and go, so Professor Collins, can you tell me what happens after the final exam? What are we going to be doing after that? And I go, well, nothing, because it's final.
It's over.
That's the end. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that, because I've really been enjoying these meetings we've been having. And, you know, so I don't know what, if that was like some cultural thing or some context, or had you heard that phrase before, but like,
oh my goodness.
Didn't actually have the idea of a class ending.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So the downside of that was that after running it a couple times, I would frequently forget to flip the hourglass.
Yes.
And then I was like, I guess I'm not doing that. Right. I'm curious for your, like what is the period you're using for your wandering monster checks, and how do you make sure that you don't forget when you're using the clock timer?
It's interesting. So obviously in classic D&D, there's supposed to be a wandering monster check every 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and I'm doing it every 15 minutes. Partly just because it's very visual for me on my watch, right? Mm. So I know it's specifically on the hour, 15 after, half past, and quarter to the hour.
Gotcha.
So when my watch gets to those like visually, you know, distinct locations on my watch that highlights that I need to make a wandering monster check there. And then, you know, the math behind that is, so if I have a 4 hour session, that's 16 checks, 1 in 6 chance. So I'm guessing there might be two or three wandering monster encounters per 4 hour session, which feels about right. There are times when I think that I actually need more and should switch back to 10 minutes, but it's 15 minutes, partly just to be visually obvious on my watch.
Neat. Very cool. I'm reminded that James Raggi's Death Frost Doom actually specifically instructs you to do this. There's a specific mechanic of like, when they walk into this room, this thing happens, and it will then set a timer, because every 10 minutes you have to do this.
Great.
And it's great. It really like ramps up the tension. And that game is all about like this constant ramp up of tension until the release of the horrible, horrible things.
Right. I got to say, my players are really keyed to the wandering monster checks. They really, you know, you can feel all of them cringe.
Yeah.
When I go, it's time for a wandering monster check, and they all cringe and they lean forward and they go, they're really, really hoping for no wandering monster.
That's funny.
And it's an interesting element how much, you know, how much they really, truly hate it.
Yeah. You know, I would also be tempted, I don't know if you ever tried this, but I feel like I would be tempted to make them roll. Have you ever done that?
I see why. I have not done that. I like that being on my coming out of my hand. Like I almost don't want one of the players to like receive the negative energy that I'm receiving.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to be the heel on that one.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right, let me, I have a thing to show. So here's something I've done in my actual campaign, and I'm going to do something a little different here. If I can remember how to do this. Okay, so this is actually a little on the table here next to me. This is my binder. We talked about binders at one point. This is my binder for my my BX campaign that I ran for a long time. And I specifically had a section in here where I was printed out this template of just a lot of empty check boxes with a line under it. And I sort of did this in lieu of a calendar. I wasn't keeping like a specific calendar, but anytime something happened in the game that required or that triggered off a time passage, I would write a line down here. So over here, I have like, here are 3 charm victims. And so I wrote their names down, and I knew how many days the charm was going to last for. So I crossed off the extra boxes, so there was just enough boxes of the duration of the charm. And then each day I would come in here, and basically anytime a day passed in my campaign, I would flip open the book and just go through and tick boxes, tick, 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 tick.
Nice.
And see if anything ran out.
That's great.
I found that to be really actually super helpful. So anything from like, you know, somebody's charmed, or we have so many days of we've paid for our inn. Amusingly, the lycanthropy example, I had a character who was an elf who got bit by lycanthropy, and according to the rules, they die.
Right.
So I had a death counter for that character, and the player had no idea what was going on. And I just, every time I would take off boxes, I would describe to him how much worse he felt. And the funny thing was, it freaked him out. He eventually decided, because the time was passing because the other players were doing things in town and consuming days.
I see.
And I'm like, oh, you don't feel, oh, you really don't feel it. He finally decided to flee. He got on his horse and rode. And I'm like, all right. That character never comes back. End of story. Sorry, guys. What happened to him? I died on the road out there.
This is what I mean when I say D&D is just naturally a horror story.
Like, if at least if he was in town, I would have gotten to, like, describe his, like, you know, becoming an invalid, and maybe the other players would have helped him. But he fled.
You know, I'm also thinking of that from the perspective of the horse.
I mean, and then, of course, it's moments like these where you, like, you're like, I'm going to bank that because, you know, someday I'm going to run a campaign where my players come across a dead elf on a horse. You walk it down the road.
Totally.
There's a horse with a corpse strapped over its back.
Totally.
Slumped over it. What's going on?
Totally. Yeah. So I'm seeing, so William there is saying time can get loosey-goosey when the party splits in the dungeon. And I want to say, what the hell are you doing? Don't let them do that.
Why are they splitting up? We've talked about splitting up before, and actually how I actually love it for horror. It does, it does get weird when it, or even when they're just in different locations, right? Like if I don't know, it can happen, right? Like the party goes back to town and the wizard is doing his research and another player says, well, I need to ride off to this town to do this, accomplish this thing. I'm just going to run this message or something, something. And now you've got players in different locations and it gets difficult.
I mean, again, with me, with my, like, I don't even get in there and ask that. That's actually one of the things I'm trying to tamp down a little bit in my game, actually. But, you know, it should be allowed. It should be, you know, it should be on the table, honestly.
Well, that's why I would go for the counter method. I'm a big believer in sort of like, don't do anything until it matters, right? Like when, if a player is, I'm stealthily sneaking into this fortress, I don't say, okay, roll your move silent. I say, we'll roll your move silent when it becomes important.
Right. Which is great. Which is super great.
Right. Yeah. Okay, now there's a chance someone hears your roll, right?
You know, and I had a tiny, you know what? It's interesting because I actually learned from you how to handle this, because on Friday night, I actually had a tiny sliver of this where I had, and this was a major culmination point, actually, for a whole lot of months of the game. I had the group come into a giant temple area with a big boss, and the thief was invisible and snuck into the boss's room and started rummaging through their stuff invisibly while the other players were interacting and communicating with a person with a bunch of monsters actually that they could communicate with. And so I totally did your thing of flip back and forth three times between the two parties. And at one point the thief was like, oh, I found the big trunk. I picked the lock. Okay, let's roll to see if you picked the lock. Great. Totally works. I flip open the lid and I switch back to the other party. I switch back to the other party before I come back and tell them what they find in the trunk. So that actually worked. That actually worked really well.
That's a nice tension builder. I enjoy that a lot.
That one from you.
William also mentions the thieves and rangers scouting ahead, and I'm just shaking my head here of like, have we learned nothing from Bilbo? Like, the scout's job is observe and report, not observe, get into trouble, and need rescuing. Oh, that used to irritate me so much in our old campaign that we played many years ago. We always had those scouts who were like, I'm gonna look ahead. Oh, there's something interesting. I'm gonna go get involved.
Yeah.
No, come on, don't do that. Back into the party.
You're right.
Cool.
Hey, what were those boxes in your tracker? What did the boxes represent? Because you had some that were like a whole bunch of boxes, and then had ones that had less. So difference there?
They're generally always days. They're always days. Okay. And you can see I keep like sort of one line, two line, four line, five lines.
Right.
And you know, when I print them out, they're just blank like this. They just look like this. And the point is just to not give myself too many boxes. If I know something's going to last a week, I'm going to write it down here. Whereas something's going to last a month, I write it down up here. And I'm trying to look at these and actually remember what the heck was going on some of them. I mean, certainly I'm pretty sure that over here somewhere is our dying lycanthrope guy. Yeah. This one definitely says that we have three charm victims. These are this is a counter of grooms that were hired to watch the party's horses.
Yeah.
Once my party had a significant train of hirelings and horses and whatnot, they started to hire people just to watch them while they went into a dungeon or whatnot.
Yeah. Cool. Cool.
And then more often than not, the ticker is just the pay ticker of they want more money.
yep. Cool. Here's my analog. See, now my light is insane here. So is that visible at all?
Oh, it is. It is if you lift it up high enough to block the sun. There you go. Tip it towards the camera.
So there's my analog where I have a roster. I just have a time tracker roster of and it's basically just when does the game session start and when does the game session end?
Mm-hmm.
And I have the real date and then I have the in-game date and then I have a couple notes that's circled here. I have a couple notes about long-lasting spells for when they start, so when I know that they're going to end at some point. That's how I'm currently doing that. I like your method a lot.
Let me show another thing that's fun from a Warhammer game I ran. So this was when I was running the Enemy Within, which unfortunately only lasted a few sessions and then ended because of logistical problems, just getting people in the room at the same time. But here's a case of passing the responsibility onto the player. So I made this thing. This is just a standard, blank book diary that you can get at any bookstore, right? I went for the dotted pages, so that players could write either text notes, but as well as there's some maps. You can do some mapping in there. But the idea was that this was meant to be the game journal. So in the beginning, in the first couple of pages, I glued some extra pages in. So here we have a map of the Empire, so the players would know what's going on. And then the calendar, the Imperial calendar. Let me see if I can get this a little closer to the camera there. So this is, and Warhammer has a very evocative calendar. It's, it's got 8-day weeks, and then there's interstitial days that happen between months and all kinds of interesting stuff. But also because that adventure, that campaign, Enemy Within, has that kind of timeline, it was important to know where the party was on this. So what I did with this is I gave this to the players and I said, it's your job to keep notes and tick days. And in fact, I bribed them. I said, you can pass it around. You can share who's going to be keeper of the journal for each session. And that person gets some extra experience points.
Wow.
And that was also that person's job on the subsequent session to recap and tell everybody, here's what happened last time. And they would go back and look at their notes. And they would recap what happened. I also did a thing where I flipped it over and on the back I wrote a little, we have a little pocket here where their handouts went. And then I made a little title here where I wrote notable persons of consequence, aka NPCs.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And so then the players would write down people that were important to them. I was pretty excited about this. I was hopeful that it was going to become this really fascinating, relic. But as you can see, we got maybe three pages in, and then unfortunately the campaign stopped. It was, like I said, it was important for me to know where we were on the calendar, and it was just convenient for me to kind of force the players to do that grunt work for me. And I also really liked the idea of them doing the recap at the beginning of each session. Not only to remind us where we were, but so that I as DM wouldn't accidentally say things they didn't realize, right? Too much detail.
Totally on target with that. Yeah, there are times when I find myself stumbling in the same thing. I go, well, you know, blah blah blah, and I'm like, oops.
Didn't realize you hadn't connected those dots.
Yeah, exactly. Doing stuff like that. You know, it's funny because I haven't formally asked my players to write recaps, and then they actually they fell into it without me asking. Is that there's they make I don't even make it, but Max makes a an event listing on Facebook, actually, to tell us all every other week. And he got in the habit of writing basically it's always a joke. Like it's like just four sentences, like jokily commenting on what ridiculous thing happened last time. And I actually kind of want to scrape the Facebook page of all that stuff because it's gold.
Yeah.
It's hilarious and it's funny and it's horrible. And once in a while, someone else steps in and writes that instead.
Yeah.
And I never would have thought that they would do that, but it's actually like really a real treasure.
At the beginning of my BX campaign, our friend BJ was playing, and right. He keeps a blog at SaturdayNightSandbox.blogspot.com, I believe is the URL.
Yep.
And he was writing blog entries after every session in character. He would write in character journal entries, and they were wonderful. They were so good.
Right.
Like anytime a player bothers to do that, it's so good.
Yes.
Unfortunately, he eventually had to move away, and I remember in as a going away present when he had to move, I scraped all of those entries off of his blog and printed and bound them in a book.
Oh,
and I said, here
that's
it
the
is.
Best.
Here's the book that's of the book of your character's journal.
In our campaign, like if you go on my blog, the start of 2018, I was writing recaps myself for a while, but I'm too verbose, frankly. I'm too verbose, and it was taking up too much time. And at some point, at kind of an awkward point, I ran out of time. And then when the players were doing this like four sentence summary, I was like, oh shit, that's what should be happening.
That's much smarter. When I gave the journal out, I would say like, it's your job to keep notes. You could be a couple bullet points. It's fine. It doesn't just major events.
Yeah.
And then some of them got more verbose and wrote funny stuff and told each other jokes and wrote stuff from the perspective of their character, which is obviously skewed or whatever. And, you know, they would have fun with it. But yeah, it was always like, no, really, like it could just be like three bullet points per session. That's fine.
I say that I'm going to do something like that, and then I just can't. So actually, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I think forcing the players to do it is great. If a player decides to do it on their own, that's fantastic. The other thing I love about player-generated in-character is that, for me, that is immediately an in-game relic. And I'm remembering now when BJ left, I told my players, you can find this character's journal. It's out there in the world. So if you read his old blog entries, and this was happening, players were coming and joining the campaign well after he had left. And I said,
okay.
If you want to dig up his blog and read it, that's fine. That exists in the world.
Brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant. Brilliant. That's the best.
I love doing that. The other thing I love doing is that when a player dies, I always ask them, if you've drawn any maps or taken any notes, please give them to me. Because then I keep those, and then that's a relic in the world somewhere.
I should do that. Yeah,
that's super fun. There's nothing quite like, and I once sold them back one of their own maps, which was great. they were like, we need a map of blah, blah, blah location. And I was like, oh, there's a sage. He's like, yep, I found this old record. Somebody visited that place and drew a map, and they sold them, and I handed them back the handout of
a
map
it's
drawn
funny.
By one of them.
It's funny when like game tropes, right? Game tropes like feed on themselves, or the game tropes become you're making maps. Maps are a thing. You can buy maps. Now you've bought your own map,
right?
Because what my players have gotten into is they've started participating with the rumors news rule that I use in original D&D, right? And of course you use this a similar thing. Go to a bar, spend money, get a random rumor back. Well, my players have started to want to be on the other end of that. Like they've said, can I go to a bar and like get money for like telling stories, right, about our experiences in the horrible dungeon? Can I go do that? Or they've been, here's what we should do. We should go to the bar and we should start spreading false rumors that X is in location Y when we know it's really in location Z.
Yeah.
So it's really funny when they build on the in-game tropes and add, say, I want to be on the other end of that now.
Yeah, I had a group do that as well, where they specifically like found a good source of treasure at a location, and they were in a town where, which I described, had other adventurers were coming seeking out, and they specifically went back to town. We're like, we're going to spread false rumors. We're going to spread false rumors about where it is, so that people don't find it. And I'm like,
I really enjoy that.
It's so
good. There's something about that I really enjoy. If it's not like a magic spell, and it's not like you had to put your life on the line, It's just like, I'm just going to go to the bar and just lie.
Just lie.
And that's...
Oh, it's so good. So good.
Yeah, it really is.
William makes a great point about, like, one of the nice things about making your players recap is finding out what's important to them. You know, depending on how much you plan ahead, if you're like me, where you're like, oh, if the players come up with a great idea, obviously it must be true and I'll write it down. Yeah, I love that. I love that too.
That's great.
We've gotten a little bit off topic here on time.
I agree. The Warhammer calendar was very interesting. When you play other, like when you, your BX game, what did you use for like a calendar?
I use the real calendar. I can't be bothered.
I'm very close, right? Okay, so I am exactly 2 inches away from that. So I'm basically there, except that just to give it a flavor, a little bit of, and so now so if my players listen to this, I'm revealing something I don't think that they realized. Is I will go, similar to the like use a real clock issue, I will go and get like a real actual historical feature and just overlay it on my game. And I believe most of the time players think that I made it up. And so I think that some people think that I'm more creative than I am. So in my game, I just went and got the original Roman calendar. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually just using that in my game.
Is this the thing you have another? Am I
correct? So this is listed. This is the calendar of Romulus.
There it is.
Yeah. So basically that's my. So that's just a screenshot off Wikipedia, actually. Mm-hmm. So that's actually the calendar I use in my game. So it's more or less the real world with different names. This particular calendar, actually, there's debate about whether this was a real thing or whether this is like legendary or not, actually. Hmm. But it's great for my game. I don't care. It you know, works for the game, so that's what we use here. So, you know, it's like months are about 30 days, good enough. You know, they have Roman names. Once you get to the 5th, 6th month, they're basically just the numbers 5, 6, 7 in Latin.
Yeah.
And then the interesting things, and so like months 5 and 6, which were originally Quintilis and Sextilis, were later renamed to the emperor's you know, Julius and Augustus, so that became July and August. And then my players actually complained, right, that when you get to September, so I said, now it's the month, you know, it's Mensis September. And they were like, well, what happened to all your fantasy made-up names? Because now that one's actually just the real normal name. Did you forget to rename that one? And so recently, so then I went to a Latin language forum, and I asked people, why is that? What's the etymology? What could a different name be? And so now, just as of Friday, now I'm calling them Septimilis, Octivilis, Nonilis, and Decilis.
Nice.
And so I got into a thing with one of the players on Friday. They said, like, what season is it currently? And I said, I just told you it's the first of Septimilis. Weren't you listening to me? Right. So. Lauren, if Lauren's listening, that was actually the first time you'd ever heard that. So of course it was totally unfair for anybody to know what that was. But I said, yeah, this is the start of fall is what this
That's
is.
Funny.
And the other interesting thing is if you look at, actually just bring that up again for a second. Sorry, sure. Paul, is you notice there's no January, February, right? Mm-hmm. There's only 10 months.
Yep.
And the last row there is this 51 in parentheses. And so at least the legend or whatever is that in the winter that we know as January, February, you just couldn't do anything, so they didn't bother to apply months to it. There's just 50 days that's just the winter.
The winter.
And so in my game, yeah, you get to the end of December, and then I just hand wave, and I go, and now it's winter, and you can't do anything.
Yep.
Fast forward 2 months.
That's great.
You want to do research, you want to learn a new language, that can happen. We're going to just hand wave that. And then the first of the year, and then we're at the first of you know, Mars or March, and that's the start of the new year, which is also interesting because to me that sort of explains why the leap day is at the end of February, because technically that was the last thing that was ever tacked onto the calendar.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I love this. My problem is always I get annoyed when the game calendar and the real world get out of sync.
Really?
Yeah. So generally, like my instinct when somebody says, well, what season is it? What time of day is it? Or, you know, what month is it? I look out the window and I say, oh, it's late fall. Leaves are all over the ground. It's getting a little chilly. First frost just set in. Right. Like I can give so much detail.
Okay.
off the top of my head because I'm just describing the real world. And most players don't realize I'm doing that, but it's hilarious and it works great, except that then when you get into the moments of like, oh, well, now our characters spend the next 2 months doing blah, blah, blah. And I go, oh, crap, now I'm off by 2 months.
Yeah.
Now I'm annoyed. I've not found a solution to that.
Well, maybe this is why Gygax had to put in all caps, Paul. A meaningful campaign cannot occur if accurate time records are not kept. Yeah, I don't know how loud I have to tell you this.
I guess so. It's unfortunate, though, because I hate having to think. I always want...
Yeah,
and that's a great quote from Paul. I hate having to think, but no, I want when players ask me something, I want to give them an answer right away. I don't want any delay. I don't want to have to be one time. Let me check my records. Like no, it's
yeah. I mean, I will say so. My text log. That's the one thing that I look at when I get started. So at the session start. So that's the second page in my folder here. Mm-hmm. And before each game, I just look at that one page and go, what is this date? And it's the first thing I jot down on an index card that I use to record the session.
Nice.
So it works. It's pretty, it's pretty brief for me. It's just like one thing. Just tell me what the month is.
So the other thing I wanted to comment on, sorry, I love that you're using Roman stuff. I have done that all through my last campaign. My whole campaign world is hinged on it being a medieval place with an old dead empire. Yeah. That's called the Emorian Empire. Emor is just Rome backwards. There's my big reveal. Yeah.
Damn.
A lot of the NPCs are just historical Roman figures and I play with that a lot because it's I just love that notion of like you living in a time period where there was once a previously more advanced civilization that is now gone. And the easiest analog is Rome. Like
Totally agree. And I'm constantly surprised by how much of stuff I can get away with is just purely just historical.
Yeah.
And most of my players are like, oh, what a fascinating detail that you've created for this, right? And I'm like, oh, that's that's interesting. If I just read a lot and some time goes by, nobody knows about that. I hadn't considered.
I mean, and I would surmise that probably Gygax was doing this as well. If you look at the OD&D monster list, awful lot of ancient Greek and Roman mythology in there.
It started off basically all that.
Yeah.
Basically just a list out of a Greek-Roman monster list.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to inject into this is how healing works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so or like I feel like the whole recovery recovery in general, which is health, healing, maybe some spells. So one thing that I've thought about for my campaigns is you're running a campaign and you're doing a whole bunch of adventures. And one thing I personally don't like is a cartoonish level of advancement. So one thing I don't like is to look back at a game and go, we have been playing for 6 months and our characters have gone from first to 10th level, right?
Mm.
Within the course of an in-game calendar year. They've gone from peasants to castle-owning lords in 6 months' time.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that like classic D&D can possibly promote that by having the healing be fast enough that the characters can recover in a single night and then go back into the dungeon every single day and not have time for the monsters to recover.
Hmm.
And so, in original D&D, that slice about how to manage time is right after how the natural healing works. So those two things are very, very, connected. So that's why, and this is very, very, I've analyzed like the healing rates on my blog, and now in fifth edition, out of the book, the healing rates I think are 1,000 times faster than they were in original D&D.
But very interesting. I mean, I feel like I would be tempted at this point, if I was going to run a fifth edition campaign, to say I'm going to go with long rest is a week and short rest is a day.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's what the DM in our fifth edition game is thinking about too. I agree. I'm glad that they thought about that with the variant they wrote. That sounds. I was like, yeah, that seems like a, and it is. It's surprisingly elegant thing to be able to adjust the dial on.
Yeah,
I get praise them for.
I mean, I agree with you that I would like to see more in-game calendar advancement.
Yeah,
along with the level gain, I think that is enjoyable. We're bordering a little bit on. I don't know if we're going to talk about this another time, but the topic of aging, right?
Right.
Do characters age and whatnot.
At one time, I thought this was going to be part of this conversation. So now maybe that's a separate topic now. At least for healing, so I use something pretty close to... So original D&D, you only gained half a hit point back per day of rest. Mm-hmm. So at least in my game, between not having any clerics to heal you, not having daily healing, healing about half a hit point per day, it takes weeks to recover from one dungeon exploration.
You're saying half a hit point. Do you mean half a hit die?
No. Original D&D was half a hit point per day.
Interesting. And have you changed that? Because I want to think that you tie it to level or hit dice.
Yeah, I do a level per week.
Okay.
You know what?
Okay.
So if you're third or fourth level, you're regaining 3 hit points per week, or about half a hit point.
Yeah.
So at third level, it's the same. So yeah, I do a level per week.
Yep.
Is what I do. So it might take 2, 3, 4 weeks to recover from injuries naturally, mm-hmm. and that actually managed to slow down the whole campaign pacing, I think, in a way that I like. And as a result, like, what I'm finding is my game pacing is running about 1.5 times ahead of real life. So in 2 real years of playing, we've covered about 3 years in the game. And that's almost exactly what Daniel Boggs said the other week that happened in Arson's games.
Interesting.
I'm noticing. So I'm pretty happy with how that's working
in my
game.
That's great. I did once do a big leap. I'm now remembering in my BX campaign, because of my alternate critical wounds chart, that limb loss was a big problem for them. And so big major party goal was to find ways to cure limb loss. And they pursued various things. Ultimately, the thing that they decided to go do was to seek out the tree of life and the root of all magic. And so they had to go to this crazy primordial place, and they went there. And I had written for myself in my little prep notes of, you know, each day they spend in this place is a year, right? Like, it feels like a day to them, but it's in fact a year. Right. And they then proceeded to camp there for weeks. And I went, oh, geez. And they came back decades later. I'm like, all right.
And you let that happen.
I let that happen for the whole campaign.
Okay.
Everyone you knew is either old or dead.
That is, that's amazing.
It was great. It was good.
That's
fun.
Completely invaluable. that's priceless. That's totally amazing. Did they have, what happened to their stuff? Did they have stuff? And was it like...
Like stuff that they left behind that was now in peril?
Yeah, I mean, so did they probably didn't have castles? No?
No, they weren't that high level. No.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it was mostly a wash for them, apart from the, like, oh God, now we have to meet all new NPCs because, the political jockeying for who's going to be king is just no longer relevant.
Okay, right. It's amazing that you committed to that. It's really amazing that you went when I think what one of the highest pieces of praise I can give is when a DM commits to just ditching their entire campaign due to a result like that. So when Max let me nuke his game with a nuclear weapon the other year. And when you just let your whole campaign just like disappear in decades of time, that's a really amazing level of commitment.
It's, you know, it wasn't, maybe I would have resisted it more if it had like really upset the apple cart too much, but I was like, it's just a couple NPCs I got to tune and, you know, it's funny. So Fred is asking a really interesting question about, trying to make 5e more old school and keeping that palatable to the current modern 5e crowd. How do we make these old school concepts more palatable to the players who have no basis in old school play? And I think honestly, like one of the things, like if you want to advance, if you want more time to pass by, I would lean on the things that are actually in the 5e book, like we were just talking about, of changing the duration of long rest and short rest, and just pointing out like, no, that's a legit option. It's an option in the book. Likewise, I would point out that all of the races beyond the original four, right, dwarf, elf, halfling, human, they're all also listed as optional. they're all, and there's notes in the book about how, like, maybe these are super rare or don't exist in your campaign world.
Right.
Another piece of advice someone gave me recently, I can't remember where this came from, was like, Wizards has published a the sort of like basic rules, which is like a trimmed down version of 5e, which just has the original four classes, just has the original four races. It's free. You can go find the PDF of it. So consider running a 5e game just using that as your resource and saying, I'm not using any of the extra splat books or none of the extra add-ons, just this is our one and only source. I think that'll also bring you back a little bit more.
Let me throw one little observation. Like, as a newbie, as me, a newbie 5th edition player, I've played in about three sessions of a 5th edition campaign with someone that knows both old school and new school and does a great job as a DM. Like, I've seen some people say that, like, you know, 5th edition, it's really hard to die in. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen someone say, you know, the fact that you go on this death track and then you need to fail three saving throws in a row over three rounds makes it pretty hard to die. We've actually had a lot of character deaths, and it's not because of that track. It's because of the take damage, double your hit points, and you're automatically dead rule. That's actually where I think all of our player fatalities have come from. And to me, that feels, you know, pretty gritty. So I would say, like, pay attention to that times two damage rule, because that's actually where all of our player fatalities have come from.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I also have a copy or a couple copies of printed and stapled together on hand of the Old School Primer by Matt Finch. Great little resource. Hand that out. You maybe even just trim out the DM part of it, so it's just a couple pages. And you can hand that to new players. The nice thing I like about that is it not only explains the mentality, but it explains the reason why, right? Why do you want rulings, not rules? Why do you want, you know, to throw away balance? I think that's pretty nice. It's a nice little, here, read this on your own time.
That's great. There are a couple things in the Old School Primer that I would quibble with.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I think you and I disagree on those points. we'll have to have a maybe someday we'll have an episode here where we page through the Old School Primer and we can quibble live in front of everybody.
We must do that. That's great. We totally must do that.
But yeah,
great. I see that Space Lem is saying they've only played. I've actually played more 5th edition than somebody, because Space Lem's only played two games and I played three. And they like the half-orc bards, I see, which is great.
Honestly, as an old-school player, I think of all the non-old-school editions of D&D, I think 5th gets closest to what I want. I would even at this point choose it over 3rd for what that's
interesting.
Worth.
Interesting. I mean, to me, it looks very much like 3rd. I'll just say, like, you know, you and I played 3rd for quite a while, and I look at 5th, and it's like, to me, it looks like it's 85% the same as 3rd edition.
But, like, take, for example, look at their Attack of Opportunity rule. It's so dirt simple in 5th edition. Do you leave engagement? End of story. Nothing else. Casting within, like, a lot of people jump to this, like, oh, doesn't this provoke an attack? Nope, not in 5th, my friend.
Okay.
One thing and one thing only provokes attack of opportunities. Okay. And then,
which is my least favorite thing, but...
Right. And then I think once you've acclimated your players to, like, oh, I like old school things, you can start arguing for, I just recently convinced my 5th edition group to drop attunement because it's dumb.
Okay, cool. Good for you. Well done. Yeah.
So,
nice.
So, right, like, attack of opportunity. Okay, we'll get down to this tiny little bit of attack of opportunity. Maybe it's not that far away from, like, let's just not do that at all.
Right.
Group initiative is another one. If you can convince them to do a group initiative, the game goes so much faster.
Yes.
So much faster.
Yes. It's interesting because our DM has been doing group initiative and is thinking about switching to independent initiative. And
the problem is you have certain character classes who have abilities that hook into their initiative role.
Yeah.
Oh, I get advantage in initiative. I get these bonuses to initiative. And now, like, oh, now it's part of my character, so it's important to me that we do individual initiative.
Right.
Anyway, way off topic here. Any final thoughts on time?
I like knowing that time has elapsed in the campaign. I like being able to say that happened 2 years ago, that happened 3 years ago. I like feeling that time progress.
Yep.
You know, I don't try to track people at different times and different calendars, like Gygax apparently had to in his games when he had lots and lots of different people showing up day to day. But I, so, you know, part of the reason why I get clerics and part of the reason why I slow down healing is specifically to see time pass. And when my players start, you know, researching spells and take weeks and weeks of time, I like feeling those seasons pass. I like, you know, having things pop up and then go, boy, that was quite a while ago now. So I like my fairly simple track it on the legendary Roman calendar system. And that works. I'm pretty happy with my campaign. This was a sore spot for many years in prior D&D. And now I'm pretty happy with it.
Great. My general 2 points of advice would be: one, use the real world wherever you can. Use real clock time. Use the real seasons if you can get away with it. I find that to be really nice. And then delegate the bookkeeping to your players if you can. I found that to be very helpful.
Interesting. I love the session summaries. That's pure gold.
Yeah, I'm actually really looking forward to running another campaign at some point where I will again try to, you know, and even to the point of bribing them with XP. Whoever keeps the notes tonight gets the bonus XP. Here you go. Seems to be enough to make it happen.
It's a good idea.
Great.
Should I remind people, Paul, about when our last show of the season is?
Yes, please do. When is our last show?
Yeah, so we are calling this first year of Wandering DM Season 1, and we are planning to have our last show of this season on Sunday, December 8th, and then we're going to take a brief break, and that show, I believe, will be on the subject of endings, actually, in games. So we'll be taking a brief break for the holidays and then returning for a new year with Season 2 of Wandering DMs with lots of exciting new topics and special guests and convention videos and wanderings about the globe.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Dan.
Yeah.
If you have any thoughts on tracking time in your D&D campaign, we would love to hear them. Please post your comments below this video. Tell us how you track time or what effects it's had in your game or how you've made it more manageable. Or give us new ideas of other things. Do you want to hear about aging effects? Let us know what areas you'd like us to dive into more, and we'll look at doing a future show on such topics.
That's a great idea. Remember, everybody, that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle Wandering DMs.
Our episodes are available in an audio-only podcast version in all of the podcast delivery methods that are available. If you're listening to this podcast on a podcasting app, please consider rating and reviewing us. Or you can find our podcast also on our website at wanderingdms.com.
That's great. And thanks to all of our patrons who support the show currently. And if you'd like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Remember, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.